Okay, get this started. My name is Ron Tarver. I teach photography here at school, and thank you all for coming out on this really beautiful day. I'm here to introduce Dorcas. Dorcas has been my student way too much. So she's taken a couple of classes, an independent study class, and has done some really amazing work. This work that she's done, that she's going to talk about, was work that she did last summer in Puerto Rico. I'm sorry, Costa Rica, the other P word. But she did really amazing work there. She spent a lot of time shooting and calling me for help, so which I appreciate. This is a big project for anybody to take on, even a seasoned journalist. I mean, we talked about that and how she should approach the project. I come at this from a journalism point of view. I was a photographer at a newspaper for a long time, and I told her that the best way to do it is make contacts, which she did. And once you get on the ground, you just have to sort of figure it out when you get down there. And it's a difficult thing to do a story like this, especially telling a story that hasn't been told before. And I think that the picture she came out with, while it's not the finished thing, she's going to go back this summer. I think is a really good start. So with that, I'll introduce you to Dorcas.
Thanks so much to Ron for that wonderful introduction. I remember, calling Ron and texting him, like, right before I was leaving. I was like, oh my God, Ron, like, what if I'm super socially awkward? Like, what if I take shitty photos? Like, can I borrow a camera bag? And, he just kind of texted me back. He was like, okay, first of all, you are socially awkward. Go take photos, and here's the camera bag. So, that speaks to the person that Ron is and has been for me, just this great amount of support. So, my name is Dorcas Tang. I am a studio art major, double minor in educational studies in Spanish, although my parents still hold up hope for me to be a lawyer someday. So, thank you all so much for being here and supporting me on this wonderful day with beautiful weather. I'd like to acknowledge that we are standing on Lenape land, so colonizer, settler colonialism. And I also want to express my gratitude for certain organizations and people before we start. So to the Genevieve Chingwen Lee Grant, established in memory of Genevieve Chingwen Lee, class of 1997, and support for projects that talk about Asian American studies. The Lang Center for Civic and Social Responsibility. So without these two, I was able to realize this project without any financial stress. Thank you to Professor Edwin Mayorga, Professora Nancy Buisa, and Professor Christopher Fraga for graciously supporting me and giving me invaluable advice. And finally, thank you to Swarthmore College Libraries, specifically Roberto Vargas and Susan Dreyer, for really allowing me this platform to speak on my project and also my first solo exhibition. This would not have been possible without you guys. Finalmente, mi gracias a la comunidad china en Punta Arenas. Gracias por compartir sus historias conmigo, por tener confianza en mí en contar sus historias. Este charla está dedicado a ustedes. Then I wanted to start with the name of the project. It's called Los Paisanos de Puerto. Los Paisanos was a term that means countrymen. So it was a term of endearment that the Chinese folks would use to refer to one another. And El Puerto refers to the port town of Punta Arenas. So the title literally means Chinese people from Punta Arenas in a more poetic way. And this topic isn't something that you kind of just accidentally stumble into, right? So, it's very specific. I was basically studying abroad in Costa Rica. I was volunteering in a school, and my third and fourth graders would come up to me and ask me, do Chinese people eat rats or dogs? They would pull their eyes back, and I was like, Oh my goodness. Like, this is something else. But, you know, and it was the first time I had ever felt so conscious of being Chinese all the time, because I would be referred to as like Chinita, like China. And at the same time, I also knew that there was this really big Chinatown in the capital. So it was the Barrio Chino, and that got me kind of thinking, like, it's fine for me as a foreigner to kind of feel these questions of constantly being othered, right? But what was it like for someone who was born and raised there, you know, their parents are from there, grew up there all their lives, but still face these questions? So what was that experience like for these folks? And so I had some of these questions that I was thinking about, and I kind of want you guys to, you know, sit with while I'm presenting. So, you know, what does it mean to be Asian? What does it mean to be Latinx? What overlaps or intersections exist between Asian and Latinidad? What can we learn from underrepresented diasporic narratives? And what is the power of visuals in telling these narratives? So I focused on the very specific time frame of 1855 to 1955, partially because of my own relationship with my identity, my diasporic identity. So I identify as third generation Chinese Malaysian. It was kind of the story that I didn't see talked about a lot, you know, that we were this multi-generational identity. And I really was focusing on the living narratives, right? I had come across a good amount of academic research focusing on the histories of these communities, but not necessarily anything talking about what it meant to be Chinese in Costa Rica today. It was also important for me to visibilize these communities because for me, seeing is believing, right? And so what I ended up doing was, you know, taking photos of portraits of this community and having conducted oral interviews with the folks who I encountered. And, you know, photography has this kind of long history of exoticizing and othering folks, especially when you look at publications like National Geographic. You know, that is very it has a kind of a problematic history. And so I was constantly aware of this relationship, and, you know, I am Chinese, but I felt like I treaded the line of insider versus outsider positionality with this group, right? I had a professor, before I left, she very bluntly asked me, you know, why the fuck should these people tell you their stories? And that was a question that kind of sat with me throughout the whole time, you know, why should they tell me their stories? And so these were kind of going through my mind as I was in Costa Rica. So I did want to talk a little bit about the context of this community. In 1855, you have 77 indentured laborers stepping off from arduous boat journey, arriving from southern China to the Pacific side of Costa Rica for the first time. They step foot onto strange soil, a journey precipitated by what we call now the Trans-Pacific slave trade. So this is European businessmen seeking cheap replacement for slave labor. And this group of Chinese bachelors mostly endured harsh and inhumane conditions. There was records of them committing suicide, which was seen as a means of escaping and returning back to China. And, you know, there was significant anti-Chinese legislation in Costa Rica in addition to anti-black sentiment. So African and Chinese immigration is banned between 1862 to 1943. And so you have the start of very much this unwanted and displaced within the mestizaje identity in Costa Rica. I did not arrive through arduous boat journey. Instead, I stepped off a air-conditioned bus from the capital city to Punta Arenas. And, you know, the first salty sea air hit me, and I walked towards the small white house that had the large white porton, which is a gate, and I peered in, and suddenly this tiny white-haired grandma runs out. She grabs me by the arm. She hugs me as if I am some long-lost kin and not some random stranger who just came to the house for the first time. She's like, Dorcas, mi chiquita, ya llegaste. And it's just like, okay. She grabs me by the arm, pulls me into the kitchen as she's asking me, you know, are you hungry? Have you eaten? And which I understand is not a question, but a statement, as she plops down a plate of pork's feet and rice in front of me. And I'm, you know, I'm shoveling this into my mouth. This pork's feet tastes exactly the way my dad would make it. And I, you know, my mouth drops, not literally, metaphorically, because my mouth is full of food. But, you know, this woman, she looks like she could be my grandmother, but she's speaking in this rapid torrent of Spanish. So that was my first impression, and it was a huge cultural shock for me when I first got to in Punta Arenas. So this was me and my host grandmother. Her name was Flora Angela Lee Chang, is her name. And, you know, our relationship, we bonded just so much over, you know, just gossiping, just sharing cups of tea outside the house, and just hanging out. And she was so funny. And, you know, we just had a real blast. It was also interesting for me because I had never been able to communicate with my own grandmother. There was this huge language barrier that stood between us. It was, you know, she spoke a Chinese dialect that I never understood. But with Flora, I was able to fluently communicate with her in Spanish, which was kind of interesting and ironic. And Flora loved dancing. She would dance paso doble and boleros when her husband was alive. And this is her actually dancing a baile típico, which is like the traditional kind of Costa Rican dance, with her group of like elderly seniors. And, you know, she also talks about when she was younger. So this is her right in the center. And, you know, she's hanging out with a group of all these Chinese kids who all grew up together in the main commercial street because they all lived above their parents' businesses. And I also just wanted to play this short audio clip of Flora talking about her youth. Again, oral interviews were important to me because it gave them agency to tell their stories in their own words.
Ellos siempre preferían, decían uno, casarse con un chino. Porque por las costumbres le decían ellos que mejor, le decían siempre, ojalá que con un chino, ojalá con un chino, ya te lo decía. Pero ya, yo como nosotros teníamos solo amigos, con ticos, ya no había, y muchos chinos, pero a mí no me gustaban ni chinos. No era que no me gustaba, había muy guapos, ¿verdad? Pero es que hay gente, hay chinos, oiga. Porque hay chinos que dicen, no me gustan los chinos. Hay gente, yo conozco personas chinas que dicen, a mí no me gustan los chinos. ¿No? Hay gente que dice, usted no lo ha visto. ¿Cómo que no me gustan? No me gustan los chinos. Yo recuerdo, me decían, no, a mí que no me gustan los chinos. ¿No? Pero no era porque a mí de casualidad no, era, no había ninguno que me gustara. Pero yo sí quería muchos amigos, a todos los chinos, todos esos, andábamos juntos, nos queríamos como hermanos, íbamos a un baile. Y si estábamos bailando, entonces le decíamos, vení, vení, yo quiero ir a bailar esta pieza. Entonces jalábamos. Al rato, una pieza, ay, espérate, con vos, vení, vení, vení. Así, nadie se quedaba sentado. Todos íbamos a bailar y nos jalábamos una cosa. Y de ahí fue de la gran amistad, el cariño, todos nos queríamos mucho. Y nosotros no nos andábamos chinos con chinos, habían con ticos y picas. Y bailábamos y todos íbamos, no sé cómo cabíamos, en un solo chunche, en un solo camión y un solo carro. Yo no sé dónde salíamos, pero no era prohibido de tiempo andar un monte. Ahora, solo cinco caben, que solo cuatro. Sí, así era. Entonces, por eso es que en ese tiempo y todo, íbamos de cualquier, inventamos todos los cumpleaños, había por ahí, inventamos todos los sábados, inventamos fiestas. Primero nos íbamos a bañar a la playa, después nos comíamos un granizado, un churche, y en la anoche íbamos al cine. Después nos salíamos del cine, nos íbamos a caminar allá al muelle, pues salíamos allá a hacer los turistas. Y si no teníamos programado, oye, pues vamos a saltar, ok, venimos a saltar, nos vamos a bailar y ya todos nos volta.
Okay, so that audio clip kind of shows this really colorful history and like how much fun that Flora was just having as a young Chinese person growing up. So another really important space where a lot of Chinese folks would hang out was the Asociación China de Punta Arenas, which was colloquially known as the Club Chino. It was founded in 1907 and was established as a support network for newer immigrants coming to Costa Rica. And, you know, when I got there, I don't know if you can see, but there's this gate, there's a gate, and then there's a door, and then there's a long flight of stairs going up. So, you know, I was able to open the first door. I knocked on the gate, and this guy, like, peers at me. He's like, you know, what do you want? Like, what? And I was like, no, I just want to take some photos. Please let me in. So, you know, it was just, he was like, I'll make some calls. Like, eventually he let me in, but this was a space that clearly was not being used and was really inaccessible for a lot of people. But in its heyday, you could hear, you know, both the click-clacking of mahjong tiles and, you know, Southern Chinese dialect and ping pong and Spanish, all kind of coming together in this one space. This was the Club Chino in 1907, and you can see the Republican nationalist flag and Taiwanese imagery. And, you know, here's Flora again. She is Miss Senorita Colonia China, which is, you know, she's like the winner of this little beauty pageant, her at her wedding reception. So clearly this was a space that was really used by a lot of folk. Quinceañeras, you know, all that stuff. And then this is today. So, you know, everything is locked up. There's this one guy that just, they pay to be there to guard the place, actually. Because this one president, president of the Chinese Association had said, you know, we just want this for Chinese people. You know, we can't let other people come in and destroy the things that are in here. This was another really important space for the Chinese community, or historical. It was called La Bomba Con, and it was a gas station. It was founded in 1948. I wanted to use this space to kind of illustrate how our immigrant narratives are not necessarily monolithic, right? I had my own family, I always associated with the idea of struggle and idea of poverty. But this family, they own the whole block. You know, it stretched from this corner to down all the way to here. And they had come to Costa Rica with money. They were landowners in China. And they were like, oh, how can we make more money? Let's go to Costa Rica. So it was something that I was really surprised by. And it was very different from what I had known. Yeah, within the same family, you also have very different narratives, right? So this woman's name was Maritza Hong Acon. So she was part of the family, but her mom and her parents had actually fled communism. Since they were landowners in China, they were, you know, persecuted. And her story was pretty memorable for me. I remember, you know, spending hours in her home sipping on cold Chinese tea as, you know, we heard the sounds of the road going on outside, and she had a very bittersweet and complex relationship that she kind of navigated with being Costa Rican. In one interview, she says, I don't feel proud to be Costa Rican. You know, she recounted in this, her talk that, you know, her father, she would watch her father practice martial arts at night until his knuckles were bloody because he was preparing to, in case he ever needed to defend himself. At the same time, she had moved to the States for a really long time, never thought she would come back. But every summer she would bring her sons back to Costa Rica because she said her legacy for them was, you know, being able to teach them Spanish. So I want to play another short audio clip. This one's in English, because Maritza So.
Growing up here, I felt a lot of racism here in Punta Arenas. People who mistreat my father, and how making fun of him because we were Chinese, you know, saying the same thing. And my older brother also felt more racism because he was the oldest one. I remember one time he was coming from high school, and he was just getting here to my to the house already in the corner, and some guy, I don't know who was it, he was eating an orange, and so he will, people here eat the orange like this, squeezing it, and then you get the stopper, right? So he would just grab that and throw it at me, just because you are Chinese, and they feel like they are, they have the right to do that.
So I think, you know, this audio clip kind of, you can kind of hear the, like, pain in her voice, and shows what the result of this very normalized harassment and discrimination is. And at the end of interviewing her, I remember she told me, Dorcas, like, don't show my image online, don't put it outside of your university, because, you know, that Chinese supermarket down the road, they got harassed and they got robbed because they were Chinese. People thought they had money. So that was, you know, her relationship with Costa Rica. On kind of a more brighter note and different kind of sentiment, here is one of my favorite photos. It's kind of illustrating this idea of community. You know, they're making dumplings. This is Flora's friends and family, and they've all gotten together to make this dumpling called hagao. And hagao in Cantonese means shrimp dumpling, and usually it's about this small. And I remember, you know, this was really interesting because instead of shrimp, they had substituted for a meat filling, and they had some of them didn't know how to fold it, so they had these empanada makers, and they would just, like, squash it together to, like, fold the dumpling. So kind of like the improvisation and how the culture evolved, right? And, you know, you kind of question, like, why did these ingredients kind of evolve like this? Why did they not know how to fold the dumplings? And part of it was because, you know, when people would bring food back from Hong Kong or from Panama, Chinese ingredients, it would detained at customs, right? They would say, oh, this doesn't look right. Like, we're going to take it away from you. So, so this is a dumpling that it's actually very well folded. I can't do that. another, you know, interesting, this is at the same table, but I think it illustrates a little different story. There are two really interesting things that I wanted to focus on with this photo. First of all, the food that they're eating is Chinese Costa Rican food. So much like Chinese American food, Chinese Costa Rican food was so popular. Like, they had chop suey, arroz cantonés, like fried wontons. Like, it was even, you would even find Chinese Costa Rican restaurants that were run by non-Chinese folks. So, you know, that brings to the question of, like, why do you love the cultural products of this community but not the actual people? And then the second question I had was, you know, what is this authentic Chinese food? Like, did they think it was authentic? Did they think it was Chinese? Because they are Chinese and they are eating Chinese takeout food. So, and then another topic I was interested in was the role of religion in the community. So Catholicism is big in Costa Rica. Church and state is pretty much, you know, super intertwined. So there was a lot of the times the Chinese folks would learn about Catholicism through schools. They would teach it in schools and be converted there. And, you know, I'm an atheist, but I went to Mass every Sunday with my host grandmother, and I played church bingo for 5 hours. You know, would not, I don't know if I would recommend that, but I did it. And so this was also another religious event. This man's name is Hernan Pipe Chan, and I remember asking him, why do they call you Pipe? Like, what's the, you know, story behind that? And he was like, I don't know, you know, they called me that one day and it just stuck. So, you know, it's funny, like, nicknames in Latin America, big thing. And this was at his finca, which was his farm. And basically they had taken a virgin statue and had a procession for it. And they ended up at his house, and he served his guests, like, fried rice and tea. And so, you know, he wanted the community to be more religious and more Catholic. So this woman's name was Neri Obando Chan, and she was Pipe's niece. Big family, the Chan family was huge. But so her story was interesting because her brother, Jose Antonio Obando Chan, had died at the age of 15, trying to save people from a bus that had fallen into the sea. And he was deemed a national hero. He was on stamps. He had, like, statues everywhere. But what I was curious about was that, you know, nobody talked about the fact that he was Chinese. Like, you know, these really prominent kind of Chinese folks in Costa Rica, but why was nobody talking about this history? I guess you'll also notice that, you know, these two kind of portraits of women, I either kind of consciously and unconsciously decided to also focus on narratives of women because I connected with older women more, you know, and a lot of the times they would tell me, you know, like, oh, why do you want to talk to me? Like, that's not important. I can tell you my story in like 15 minutes. And I was like, no, like, I want to hear your story. Like, I think it is really important. So this woman's name was Sonia Hernandez Lo, and she was basically the only female Asian ping pong coach in Costa Rica. And there's something about Chinese people and ping pong. It's a thing. I grew up playing it every Saturday. And, you know, Muti, her nickname was Muti, and she would care for her father's store during the day. And every single night and on the weekend, she would train people in ping pong. And that was her true passion. That was, you know, recently she just texted me. She was like, oh, yeah, we went to the championships in Guatemala. Like, we won. And I was like, nice. So she was, like, really driven by that. And so here you see, you know, this is in the Chinese Association. They had, like, championships there. They had tables in there. And you even have people representing Costa Rica on a national level, right? Chinese folks. So another really important sport in Costa Rica was basketball. And it's, you know, this is like the nationalist, like, Taiwanese imagery. And there were, like, non-Chinese Costa Ricans on the Chinese Association's team, and they would, like, play around the country. And so this is today. This is my photo. This boy, his name is Jose Manuel Gonzalez Sanchez, and he was the grandson of of someone who was in one of the earlier photos. And, you know, so sports in Costa Rica were mostly dominated by folks who were black. And this basketball team was no exception. So I was really interested to see how these two kind of other groups in Costa Rica interacted with one another in this context. So this is Jose's older brother named Mario Jose. And on the team, Mario Jose was called Chino, and Jose Manuel was called Chinito, or Mini Chino. And it was just It was just their names, and that's what they went by. And so again, focusing kind of on these younger folks, this woman's name is Iris Lam Chen. She was a arts manager in San Jose. A lot of folks did not actually end up, younger folks left the town because in 1970s, Punta Arenas entered this steep economic decline. And so you have all of these Chinese, younger Chinese folks leaving to the capital to find work. And so Iris was a real, really strong personality. She knew exactly what she wanted and how she was gonna get it. And she talks about, you know, the interesting part of her story was that she talks about getting, bullied on the playground when she was younger, right? They would call her like China, Capuchina, which kind of like means Chinese monkey. And she describes how she would fight, like physically like fight back. So imagine this like tiny little Asian girl, like just like punching at it and like biting them back. And, you know, she was like, yeah, the teachers never did anything to stop me. They never punished me for fighting back. And I was like, but I feel like the real question is, why didn't they stop the bullying from happening, you know? So across these narratives, you also see a lot of the Chinese folks experiencing harassment, bullying in schools, but, the passivity of the teachers, they never did anything to stop it. Iris was also a lesbian. She lived with her Chinese Costa Rican partner and her partner's son, and she would say, oh, my modern family. And I'm just going to skip over this audio clip. Or I'll just play it. So this is her talking.
Costa Rica, en Punta Arenas.
Sí, porque...
En Punta Arenas era muy difícil.
Uh-huh.
Porque... nunca, o sea, era como don't ask, don't tell. Entonces, we were like very close friends to everyone. So, like, it's like our friends did know, but we were always like low profile. Always hanging out together, but never showing like care.
Affection.
That's why we always were at home. No. But for me, it was never difficult. But for her, it was.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was the Chinese one.
Mm-hmm.
No espera que los chinos sean más conservadores, ¿verdad?
Mm-hmm.
No espera que los chinos son más tradicionales, pero mi familia has been always okay with it.
¿Su familia refiere a...?
Nuclear, mamá. Porque mi papá murió cuando era muy niña, entonces mi mamá.
Mm-hmm.
Pero mi mamá worked for the college, Universidad de Costa Rica, since always.
Mm-hmm.
Y usted sabe, las universidades siempre
mi
tienen más.
Sí.
Exactamente. Las universidades siempre tienen el estándar de vanguardia.
Mm-hmm. ¿Tenía una experiencia de como coming out a su familia o...?
Coming out from what? I was never... I always thought that the straight people never come out, so why come out from where? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What closet? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's Iris talking about kind of her queer identity and how that related to her Chinese identity. And so this woman's name was Marcela Yo Soto. She was seventh generation Chinese. Her great-great-grandfather was Chinese. And oh, here she is holding a photo of her. So she had never identified as being Chinese growing up until she went to the capital city, San Jose, and people would ask her, you know, why is your last name Io? Io is not a Hispanic surname. And, you know, people would look at her and be like, you look a little different. Where are you from? So, you know, it's kind of like even after all this time, even after so many generations, Chinese people, they were still seen as this other, right? And her relationship with being Chinese was really interesting for me because she said, you know, Chinese is something I feel inside. Like, I feel Chinese. So, you know, that begs the question of, like, how do you grapple with your Chinese identity if you're mixed, even, you know, after all these generations? So, you know, these are back to my original questions, right? Like, kind of reflecting on that. And I guess some of the conclusions I came to answer my professor's question, you know, who was I to, why should they tell me their stories? And I'll just come, you know, I remember when I was there, the second week I was there, I went to a funeral. It wasn't really by choice. So I was there with my camera and I was like, you know, taking photos, like, really uncomfortable. People were, like, crying. I was like, I don't know these people. Like, you know, why? And I remember my, you know, the people who's the family of the person who had passed away, they were like, no, like, you need to take these photos. These are part of our community's stories. And, like, physically, like, pushed me to take these photos. So it was really important to them because it was the first time I think that this identity had been validated in this way, that someone had cared enough to come to this place and tell these stories. One of the people I interviewed after also told me, you know, without your project, I would never have had the excuse to talk to someone else who was Chinese, go to their house, and, you know, there had never been this platform to talk about this shared experience. Which I think was, you know, therapeutic to some extent. For me, as someone who always grappled with, you know, am I Chinese? Am I Malaysian? When I went back to Malaysia, because I grew up in China, my cousins would call me China girl. And I was like, we're all Chinese here. I don't know what's going on, but cool. And then when I went back to Shanghai, where I was living, the taxi drivers would charge me like a foreigner rate and they'd be like, where are you from? I was like, I'm here. So, you know, for me, it was always this question. But when I went to this community, it kind of allowed me to see that I didn't really need to choose between being the two. Instead, I pertained to this larger diasporic network that was part of the Chinese diaspora. And I felt, you know, I felt this kinship with this community that I had not felt necessarily in Malaysia or China. In the future, you know, kind of also coming back to this. So one last story. You know, this was my last night in Costa Rica, and I was flipping through this book, which was in the Chinese Association. It was really yellowed and frayed, but I was so enthralled by these photos of the Chinese folks. It was a book of Chinese people who had come in 1922, every single Chinese person that came. And as I was flipping through it, the president of the Chinese Association tells me how they found it. And basically what had happened was it was found discarded in heaps of bureaucratic trash. You know, it's found outside of the building in the garbage. Someone picked it up and was like, oh, maybe this is important. Let's give it to the Chinese Association. And from then on, they were like super protective of it. They were like, we're not going to let anyone take it, even for conservation purposes. We just don't trust anyone. And, you know, this kind of illustrates for me the importance of continuing to tell these stories. And for me, I am going to continue telling these underrepresented stories of the diaspora because, you know, who else will? You know, behind the lens, I am the curator and creator of me and my community. So, you know, follow me on Instagram.